Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Big thank you and welcome to everyone who's downloaded and is listening to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Behind the Scenes. Today's podcast, we're going to look a little bit at retail real estate as Regency Centers provides a pandemic update basically at the beginning of November, not looking so much through the real estate lens, but they did go into detail in terms of what their lease pipeline looks like. It's very interesting, the retailers that are looking to kind of sign on and maybe backfill some spaces that might have been left open from the pandemic. We'll also talk about this stunning news by way of Pet Value as they announce closures of all their U.S. locations. Our interview guest today is Shash Anand. He is with Soti. He is the Vice President of Product Strategy at Soti. And basically what we're going to talk about, we kind of start talking about the supply chain as it pertains to retailers picking up a little bit more curbside as a response to FedEx, UPS being overfilled. But the conversation really transitions, and we'll take a look at what is changing as far as suppliers are concerned to make sure that they are getting products to retailers on time and in the way that retailers want them so that retailers can then fulfill exactly what the customer needs. A quick reminder, if you like the podcast, you can always rate us on whichever podcast platform you're listening, and we are available on most of the big ones. Again, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, and Spotify are among the bigger ones, but you can access us on Stitcher or pretty much any other podcast listening service. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. So we dive into our first news story. And as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about Regency Centers. They provided a business update this last week. They also had an earnings call. Earnings kind of secondary to what we're going to be talking about. Most of what we're going to be discussing is their business update that they provided in conjunction with that call. Now, for those that aren't aware, Regency Centers, and by the way, one of my personal favorite REITs, they have a massive footprint where I'm at in Colorado, but also in Texas, in the Midwest, in the Southeast, pretty much anywhere you go on the Pacific Coast, they've got centers, and they're really a leader in the grocery-anchored neighborhood center space across the U.S. They do have larger retail centers as well. Their goal is to set up these centers in affluent and densely populated areas, but this usually translates into suburban or growing areas. When you see a Regency Center run shopping center, typically going to be in a suburban or growing area. They don't have too much in heavily urban locations, although you do see them from time to time. Now, these types of grocery-anchored neighborhood centers have been highly sought after by REITs, like Regency Centers, and individual investors alike over the past several years, but we've seen a lot more demand for them as the pandemic hit, and that's pushed cap rates even lower, which means to purchase one of these centers is going to take a little bit more money than it might have about 5 to 10 years ago. Now, for additional context, 45% of their tenants, based on rents, so based on the amount of rents that they're bringing in, are essential retail. So that's a pretty high number. They classify those as grocers, drug stores, general merchandise stores, pet stores, and so forth. Due to their outparcel holdings, because they typically hold on to the outparcels around their centers, about 18% of their portfolio is restaurant-based between QSRs and full-service restaurants. And then other retail and services, so things like apparel, fitness, they have a number of centers, like I said, around me. There's a lot of medical aspects to them. Those outlets make up the other 37%. Now, this business update, as I mentioned, came along with their earnings call. So let's start briefly with the earnings call. On the earnings per share front, they fell just short of analyst expectations of 75 cents per share. Their core operating earnings, as sometimes REITs will call them, came in at 69 cents per diluted share. So a 6 cent miss on analyst expectations. And generally, looking at trends year over year, most numbers were down for them. But this is understandable since, as we'll discuss here in just a little bit, not all of their tenants are paying full rent, and additionally, a few more vacancies overall than what they had last year. Again, some of this probably caused by the pandemic. I think it's fair to say Some of it may have just been organic, but it's kind of tough to suss that out given that there is so much talk surrounding the pandemic and surrounding traffic numbers due to the pandemic. Now, their net income was just 7 cents per share versus 34 cents per share last year at this time, but despite the numbers falling off, their dividend did come in at 59.5 cents per share. That's actually 1 cent above last year's dividend at this time of year, and REITs are obligated to offer a certain percentage of profits as dividends in order to retain their REIT status, but still fairly remarkable for a company that's not gleaning the full benefit of their retail tendency to keep those dividends high, likely for those institutional investors that are out there. Now, all that said, their November COVID business update did feature some bright spots. So we'll start with the good news first. And I think a lot of this information could be extrapolated to the world of retail as a whole. When you look at these neighborhood centers, you know, I know a lot of attention goes towards malls and the like, but these neighborhood centers are so pervasive in terms of the overall retail universe that I think it's a little more instructive for us to look at what's going on as far as these type of REITs are concerned. So for one, when we look at their third quarter rent collected, that did actually go up sequentially over the second quarter from 77% up to 86%. Now, this number is pretty high for a retail REIT overall, but maybe not so high for grocery anchored REITs, which we'll talk about here in a second. Now, not only is this rent collection number going up good news for Regency centers, because obviously it's more money in, but also this is good news for the tenants. It speaks to the fact that many of their tenants feel comfortable paying something close to full rent. And Regency centers, from the onset of the pandemic, was very transparent about saying, hey, you know, we do have a lot of essential retailers out there. We want to obviously make sure that they're paying us rent as necessary, but we want to have a dialogue with our tenants because the key here is getting them set up for long-term success. If you're gouging a tenant and you're forcing them to pay during a pandemic, they're going to be more likely to shut down. You're going to be more likely to have to find someone to fill that space. That doesn't work out for anyone, and it causes more labor on the part of the REIT to try to backfill that particular space. So in this case, Regency Centers, and this is something they reiterated again this week on the call, was the fact that, hey, it's a dialogue, a constant dialogue they've been having, and the fact that rent collection is going up doesn't mean that they've been a little bit more ham-fisted about collecting that rent. It means that more of their retailers that they've got in their centers are comfortable paying something close to full rent. In fact, at the end of October, approximately 97% of their overall tenants, based on annual base rent, so we're not talking about based on square footage here, but based on the amount of rent that they generate, were open and operational. Now, if you include rent deferral agreements, some of which were in place at the beginning of the quarter, 89% of the total agreed upon rents were collected. Now, again, very high number here. And Megan Martindale of CBRE told us that in the aggregate, this number is generally a lot lower for most landlords. It is, of course, going higher as the pandemic moves along. But she did mention that the expectation for grocery anchored centers would be for rent collection figures to creep up above 80% at this point. Definitely seeing that here for Regency centers. And again, when you take into account those rent deferral agreements that are already in place, 89% of rents being collected, that's pretty good for a retail REIT in this situation. Now, Regency made it a point of noting that all of their more than 400 properties, they have 414 at the end of this quarter to be exact, they have remained open throughout the duration of the pandemic. Again, speaking to the fact that they are open air, they are typically anchored by essential retailers such as grocers or the likes of maybe a Target. However, those deferral agreements that we spoke of were still in effect on 1,300 leases in total, with deferrals averaging 3 months still as of this business update. Repayments of this deferral, so again, we're not saying that they're not going to pay rent, but repayments of the deferral period are scheduled to begin in December 2020 for most of these on average. However, again, likely to be a two-way conversation, especially with COVID numbers spiking in some parts of the country, and we're starting to see threats of further shutdowns in some parts of the country. But remember when we talked about their mix of tenants as well, their core retail tenants, the tenants that make up 45% of their overall rent base, their bread and butter, they've paid 98% of rents during the second and third quarter and so far in October. So we can really see the strength in this category. Obviously, no retailer is going to volunteer to pay extra rent because they're doing well. So say grocers, for example, Kroger is a main staple at a lot of Regency centers. Kroger's not just going to volunteer to pay more in rent because their same store sales are up 15 to 20%. But we're seeing a lot of these retailers pay full rents. Some of them may be deferring, but overall, you're seeing a vast amount of health in this category. Keep that in mind for the pet value story we'll talk about later. Other retail, meanwhile, largely apparel for Regency centers, they paid 79% of October rents, which is a pretty solid number actually for that category, after that number was just 55% in their second quarter. So things do seem to be improving there as well, at least for now. Now, their president and CEO, Lisa Palmer, said in prepared remarks in the press release itself that they're seeing an increase in confidence amongst their retail tenants, and she went into further detail on the call in that this parlayed itself into actually increased leasing activity during the third quarter and also during the past month as they were giving their business update, not only with new leases executed, but extensions as well. And we think that generally, when you look at the uncertainty that exists surrounding COVID, despite this, retailers are beginning to understand what pandemic retail will look like for them. And obviously, it's going to be different for every retailer, but it also means that they're more comfortable at this point inking some extensions or seeking to expand their footprints by backfilling vacant locations, which is something we'll also talk about here in just a second. Now, to that end, Regency Centers for the quarter executed 1.4 million square feet of comp new and renewal leases. So we're talking about backfill leases, and we're talking about renewal leases largely for these retailers as they didn't build a new shopping center during the previous quarter, with a slight rent spread. So they said their rent spread was actually up 1.2% on these newly executed new and renewal leases. Now, rent spread, what that is that speaks to the amount of increase in rent versus the prior contract for that space. So for example, this number was up 5.7% for the trailing 12 months. And this is something that we've talked about pretty consistently up until the pandemic hit. The fact that despite all of this news about these massive retail vacancies, retail rents are going up still, even during the pandemic conditions, at least in Regency centers, shopping centers, but they were certainly going up by leaps and bounds before the pandemic. So we see that this number, this rent spread is down, but retail rents are still up slightly. They're just not increasing at the same rate we were seeing pre-pandemic. Overall, their portfolio ended the quarter 93.4% leased, and that number is based on square footage. That's not based on rents coming in. So this points to the fact that not everything is good news for them. I mentioned we had the good news at the beginning. This is kind of the bad news. That occupancy number was at 94.5% at the end of their second quarter. When you include their pro rata share of some of their co-investment partnerships with other REITs and other investors, this number actually falls down to 92.9%. Additionally, they saw a slight downturn in the number of anchor spaces leased. Their anchor percentage leased was down to 96% at the end of the third quarter. Still pretty good when you look at the national average, but that's down 90 basis points sequentially. And for them, anchor spaces are defined as those over 10,000 square feet. So you might see some perhaps non-traditional retailers or retailers that you don't really think of as anchor spaces in that particular category for Regency centers. Now, spaces under 10,000 square feet took the brunt of the decline and represent also the largest number of vacancies for Regency centers. Only 89.1% of these spaces were leased at the end of the quarter, down 120 basis points sequentially. So the too long didn't read version of this is that basically the anchor spaces looking pretty good as far as the number that are leased up. The spaces surrounding the anchors, those smaller shops, they're having a little bit of difficulty there. Now, at the same time, though, that category of smaller spaces, that's where they're actually seeing the greatest amount of backfill leases. They signed just two anchor backfill leases in the quarter, but 70 smaller shop space leases. So again, when you look at square feet, that's pretty even between the two, but they are backfilling the smaller shop spaces at a greater note. But the reason we talk about all of this is to talk about where they are seeing some of these benefits in terms of the leasing pipeline. Now, before I get to the leasing pipeline, we admit things could completely change in the next 3 to 4 weeks, but Palmer on the call did note that things have been fairly regional, something we knew in terms of returning foot traffic. Even going into late October, where you're seeing cases spike in certain areas, they've noted Colorado, Texas, most of the Southeast, and bits and pieces of the Northeast is seeing the best increase in foot traffic over the last few months at the time of this business update. Traffic continues to be weaker along the entirety of the Pacific Coast, where restrictions have largely remained in place during the entirety of the last 7 months, and they basically said on the call as a whole, hey, we would like to be optimistic surrounding the reopening, but given how conservative cities and the states on the Pacific Coast have been in terms of reopening things, for better or worse, depending on, you know, again, where the numbers lie, tough to be fully optimistic surrounding those particular shopping centers. And in fact, that Pacific Coast region makes up the majority of their uncollected rent. No surprise there. But tenant fallout has been much more limited for them than they might have expected launching into the pandemic. Palmer said that looking forward, there are visible green shoots, basically likening it to spring for them. And many of their tenants are on their way to recovery, even despite worsening conditions, as we've talked about in certain markets regarding the pandemic and regarding COVID-19. As far as their leasing pipeline, COO Jim Thompson said all of the following categories were hot. Home improvement. So here you think of, obviously, the larger ones like Home Depot and Lowe's, but also you think about the likes of Ace, True Value, fitting into some of those smaller anchor spaces there. Now, they do have shopping centers with the likes of Lowe's in them, but you're seeing a lot of momentum towards the smaller ones as well. Off-price, he particularly called out Sierra Trading Company. And this is interesting because, of course, that's a company that's part of the TJX set of companies. He also mentioned TJ Maxx and Burlington as being two that are seeing some momentum there. But interesting that he called out Sierra Trading, because one of the other things he noted was sporting goods retailers and sports in general are seeing some momentum. He said they're in talks with PGA Superstore over a couple of potential locations. And he said local bike shops are really seeing a ton of momentum. And I think this is interesting because sporting goods have gotten such a bad rap. And the whole idea is that, oh, well, e-commerce is taking away. E-commerce killed Sports Authority, this, that, and the other thing. Dick's is doing reasonably well. But what I think you're seeing is an increased push by people towards being active. We've heard from many retailers that people are taking an increased focus on their health. With that, there's going to be more activity. So you see Sierra Trading Company, you see bike shops, PGA Superstore. People are getting out more often. And what's more is they're starting to realize, I think, at least based on this momentum, that it's difficult to buy sporting goods online. And this is one of the things when I looked at the articles over the last 5 to 6 years talking about, well, more people are buying sporting goods online. I think it's clear that the people in the articles have probably never played sports or don't play sports, because it is nearly impossible. For example, running shoes. If running is a hobby for you, you're not going to be very likely to buy running shoes online. You're going to want to try them out first. You're going to want to go to your local running store. And that's another category where they're seeing momentum, is running stores. Again, same thing with bike shops. You're not going to want to buy a bike online before you try it out, before you talk to someone, before you have someone that you know can repair that particular bike. It's the same thing with all the experiential stuff that you've got at Sierra Trading Company. It's the same reason why you see a lot of momentum towards REI as well. And I know I'm digressing here, but this is a subject and a retail subject I happen to know quite a bit about. Now, other sectors, pet sector was really big for Regency Centers in terms of building that leasing pipeline. They're seeing a lot of momentum towards the sector, both retail and services. So you're looking at veterinary support services and the like. Auto parts, another big one. So the likes of O'Reilly, Advance, and AutoZone, as well as Napa, you're seeing momentum there. And medical support centers. So we're not only talking about medical offices, but also things that support those in the medical field. You think of sometimes the scrubs stores that you see in these type of shopping centers. So there are a lot of very positive categories that Jim Thompson and company said that they're working on in terms of the leasing pipeline. So while their occupancy rate is down just a little bit, a lot of positivity really coming from this business update. And it's interesting because the off-price stores, again, TJ Maxx, Burlington, they've been affected in a big way by the pandemic, especially those that have had to close stores in certain areas. But at the same time, they're still looking to expand. They're banking on the fact that this pandemic's going to end at some point, and they're going to be the ones, or at least they want to position themselves as the ones, that are backfilling some of those vacant anchor positions. Again, 4.0% of their anchor space is vacant as of this business update. So lots of interesting things coming from this combo earnings call and business update for Regency Centers, and the main reason why it led our podcast today. Now, coming up, we'll talk to Shash Anand once again. He is from Soti. We're going to talk a little bit about how retailers are changing things up in terms of their supply chain, but also technology that's helping retailers connect in a different way with vendors and their suppliers to make sure that customer needs are met. Talked a little bit on the podcast, actually quite a bit on the podcast over the last couple of months about strain on supply chains as sales continue to go digital. And we've talked about sales projections and how they might fall anywhere between 15% of sales going digital during the holiday season all the way to potentially 70%, which might cripple some retailers' supply chains. But here to talk not only about the supply chain, but also some mobility solutions is Shash Anand, the Vice President of Product Strategy at Soti, and he's going to join us to talk a little bit about not only mobile innovations, but also the strain on the supply chain that we're seeing across many quarters during this holiday season. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Trent. Appreciate it.
All right, so first of all, just so our listeners know a little bit about your background, a little bit about Soti's background, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the company does and what you do on the day-to-day.
Sure. So Soti is a software company that's geared towards the IT administrator of an organization. So we're an enterprise software. And what an IT manager uses Soti for is to basically manage all of the different types of technologies that they have in their organization. And more specifically, it's around mobile devices and IoT devices. And so as an organization starts using, you can think of the traditional smartphones, but also think about things like in the warehouse when you're scanning, say, some items. Think about RFID tags and RFID readers. These are all different types of technology. Think about also printers. Think about sensors. So these are all different types of technologies. And what Soti does is we help manage them. And when I mean manage them, it's about configuring these types of technologies. So I get a mobile device. I need to turn it on. I need to configure Wi-Fi, probably download a bunch of applications onto the mobile device. I need to set up security on it. And at an enterprise level, I need to do this in scale. We've got maybe some retailers have 500 stores. So how do I do this at a scale and in a one-to-many model? So that's where Soti comes in. We help take away all of that type of challenge that companies have around deploying applications, securing devices, remotely troubleshooting issues, and performing upgrades of technology as needed.
So given that lens, obviously we know that there have been issues, especially with the U.S. Postal Service, but other postal carriers as well. They're starting to throttle package delivery and the like for many retailers. We just heard Duluth Trading Company experiencing that very thing with UPS on a recent earnings call.
Right.
That being said, a lot of retailers are looking at maybe alternative last mile solutions or different ways in which to fulfill the product to consumers, especially if they don't have a brick and mortar sale in that market. From the technology perspective, what are some important things that retailers have to keep in mind in terms of implementing and looking at some of these maybe non-traditional solutions as far as getting that product to the consumer is concerned?
Yeah, it's a good point. It actually really aligns nicely with the Bricks to Clicks report that we actually put out earlier, where let's talk about consumers, right? Consumers want and perceive mobile technology as really an effective way to enable a faster shopping experience. They are looking at things to do in terms of getting a personalized experience. They're very comfortable. They're starting to become even more comfortable with even using technologies like voice, right? Using Amazon Alexa, Google Home to shop from home. You know, some of this has been instigated by COVID where they have to stay home, but some of them, even prior to COVID, are looking for that unique experience. And 50% of shoppers, as I mentioned, like to use different technologies like the voice. But we also had a survey, and from the survey, 90% of respondents were really happy with using different delivery type options, as you mentioned. So there's, of course, the buy online, pick up in store, but they're actually also, from our survey, we're finding that drone technology is also becoming popular. US consumers would say, yep, we're fine with autonomous vehicles. And that's changing the experience as well, right? It's helping us to automate that last mile delivery in a very unique way. So home deliveries, curbside pickup, self-checkout when you're at a store, these are all relatively new things that need to come about and that all retailers need to have available to their consumers if they want them to keep coming back over and over again.
So now that we've seen retailers begin to implement some of these solutions, again, you mentioned it, not necessarily brand new, but curbside, buy online, pick up in store, retailers are really rushing to kind of scale those solutions up for their customers. What are some maybe pitfalls that you've seen in working with retailers where retailers might be able to tweak the system to optimize it for the customer? And what are some things that they should be mindful of as they begin to scale up those solutions in more of their locations?
Yeah, you're right. So basically, these companies are, you know, every second matters. Every time I want to place an order as a consumer, I'm looking for transparency. And I'm looking for the fastest experience possible. And so every single second matters. And so you're right, the strain that's been put on, what we found is that many customers of ours are still using certain manual processes. Their entire technology is not fully automated. And so this is where Soty can kind of come in and help out. But what we're finding is that because every second matters, technology can help to automate a lot of these manual processes. And those become those bottlenecks. And those become those critical paths. And it's where the manual processes are still being used that we can go in and help companies build mobile applications, right? Let's take that paper and pen process away that is still being used, that is probably, it's perceived to kind of be faster initially because it's just a quick paper and pen. But what it means is there's less tracking, there's less understanding. The operational efficiencies are not there because it doesn't scale well. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to help companies take those manual processes that they're doing today along the entire supply chain from the moment a purchase is made online and trying to understand, okay, how can we automate these things? How can we make it a click of a button? The perception by retailers has been that, hey, in order to mobilize certain parts of my supply chain, I'll have to go and hire a huge set of developers. I've got to go in and build these mobile apps. It's going to take months. It's going to take years in order for us to get this. But the reality is, with the right tools in place, these mobile applications can be built in minutes. And it's a drag and drop experience. You don't need a full set of developers to do this. And these apps can be built for both iOS and Android devices. So if you have contractors that you're leveraging, they can bring their own devices in and use these mobile apps very, very quickly. So that's one area of the business where we're helping companies build mobile applications to help them automate their manual processes. And it's as simple as a form that was being used. Maybe it's a paper-based form where they're filling in the delivery details, or they're in a truck and they have to indicate the mileage that they're using. We're converting all of these types of forms into mobile apps. And again, doing it in a matter of minutes. This gives them transparency. This gives visibility into the management team. A location of these users are all well known now. So there's many benefits that escalate as soon as you start using a mobile device. I can now properly gather that information. Now, just to add to that, Trent, when you start using mobile technology, one thing that does become challenging is you also have to think about security. And security is also a big factor. And what I mean by that is, as soon as you start using more technology, there's more threats to your environment. And that's where you need a solution that can help you manage that security, manage compliance. Of course, personal information. We hear about a lot of cybersecurity attacks, credit card information that's being compromised. So this is where you need a solution, a management solution that can help manage all of those types of challenges as well.
I want to go back to that process where you're really taking it from pen and pencil to paper to a mobile application or some sort of digital application. Again, There are a lot of benefits to that, but I was wondering if you could walk us through maybe a case study, and you don't have to mention a specific retailer or anything like that, but a case study where maybe a retailer went from a very manual method of record keeping on the back end for fulfilling a customer order or for doing something on the supply chain side of things to a mobile application.
Absolutely. There's a number of them. So I have a good example. It's a company that basically subcontracts for the likes of large retailers like a Walmart and Target. And this subcontractor, essentially what they do is these big box retailers, what they do is they purchase plants from a subcontractor. And what these subcontractors do is they grow the plants, right? And so it's a harvesting type of company. And they are using a paper and pen process to essentially get orders. They grow the flowers to certain heights and then they harvest them. And they get people to come in and grab these bags of flowers and then ship them out to the right retail locations. And so there's been a lot of human interaction by using a lot of paper-based forms. And what they asked us to do is to figure out how we can convert these paper-based forms to a digital format for multiple sets of reasons. One is they were taking time to consolidate all of the different harvesters that were part of that process. And they also wanted to kind of remove paper and pen to reduce the chances of getting an infection. They also wanted to measure the time that it's taking for them to fill out these forms, which ended up being quite a lengthy process because, you know, it was like a 5 to 10 page report that they had to fill in every time they went and placed an order. And so some of the challenges were just too many physical interactions throughout the process. They wanted to ramp up their efficiencies and really reduce the interaction at the same time. So we had, in this case, we built an app to automate the product delivery process and helping to get packages ready for delivery. So we replaced a paper and pen process into a true digital kind of transformative experience by leveraging a mobile app. And this also added a few other benefits. Now they can leverage the camera of the device so they can add more of, you know, hey, I've picked this bag up. Here's my proof of kind of delivery. The app itself was created in a very short time. And now what they can do is they can actually measure the productivity of each of their harvesters. And so we've eliminated the paper and pen, but there's so many more benefits that have been added. And there's so much more measurability and visibility into what these workers are doing. They're working in a safer environment. They can use their own phones as well. And so what we're doing is now they're also able to do things like a digital check-in to check in when that person kind of arrived, as opposed to punching in a time clock. So this is kind of saving a lot of time as well. It's also ensuring social distancing as well. So that's just one example.
And that's fascinating because agricultural retail in particular is something that has always been driven by pencil and paper. So I think that's,
You're right. That's
a really great example there of a way in which technology can update something that had been done a certain way for hundreds of years in this case. But
yeah.
I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned there, which is that a number of the employees or associates that are working to fulfill, and a number of them can use their own personal devices if you want. And of course, now we think of that as being a safety concern because of COVID, but beforehand, that was more of a convenience concern. And I'm just kind of curious, of the retailers that you've worked with, that you've interfaced with in the past, how many are interested in solutions like that where employees have the ability to maybe use their own devices and so you don't have to worry about the cleaning, you don't have to worry about the safety of maybe a commonly used device across all associates that are trying to fulfill orders?
It's becoming common with, I think, contractors. So as you kind of scale, you need that flexibility. You need flexibility in getting your work applications as a retailer onto a device that is not owned by you. And it's increasing, right? And so there is a separation of personal and work on a mobile device that has to be there. And yeah, it's definitely increasing. So being able to control the apps at the app level as opposed to the entire device becomes a bit of a norm in many retail scenarios. And just to give you an example of another scenario that has come up because of these types of checks in place, we had a company that wanted to get employees to declare that they don't have any symptoms before they start their day. And so they're using that mobile app. And we also want to make sure that they're safe, right? And so we created a bit of a COVID-19 app which was designed and deployed for one of our companies, and they were in the pest business. And it's a questionnaire. It's a simple questionnaire that acts as a self-declaration from their employees, and it's submitted via an app. And it basically automatically emails their manager before the start of the day. And so managers are notified when the employee started the day. They submit all of their questionnaires. And then at that point, if the device is owned by the specific organization, it will unlock that device. If it's a personal device, they can now use it and they can now kind of go on with their day. So this is just an example of how, whether you're on a corporately issued device or a bring your own device kind of model, you need a solution that can kind of manage both of those types of scenarios very easily.
I want to backtrack a little bit to something you mentioned just a little while ago, because you talked about the need to build in security to protect shoppers, but also it's a matter of kind of conveying that security and that safety to shoppers as well, for those that might be concerned about their personal data getting out there. So that being said, what are some considerations that you take into account as far as making sure that data is protected in terms of these different or newer types of fulfillment? And then also, what are some things that you've seen retailers do as far as communicating this to the customer to make sure the customer themselves feels safe?
Right. So from a security perspective, we need to make sure that the data in transit, so as data is transmitted, it has to be transmitted over a secure channel. The next thing is, as we capture data, we're capturing credit card information, we're capturing personal information onto these mobile devices, we need to ensure that they are encrypted. And so by default, our software will allow companies to encrypt the data at rest as well as data in motion. And the other areas that we think about from a security perspective is, as you're using a mobile device, maybe that specific user doesn't need access to the App Store or the Play Store or certain settings. And so what we really want to do is we want to provide a way for you to control that device, put it into what we call a lockdown or like a kiosk mode, where only certain sets of applications are running on the device. And this helps eliminate the ability for even the end user to accidentally download an application, because what we're doing is we're essentially building a white list of apps that you can run on the device. So this is a hugely powerful feature. It ensures that the users that are using the device are using it for the right purposes. And then you have other additional layers, like you've got, you know, a password to ensure that every device that you have is password protected. There are abilities to rotate what we call your Wi-Fi credentials, so that you're automatically changing the credentials on a regular basis as per your kind of business conduct guidelines, as per your standards. And so this allows companies to really adhere to all the different compliances, and they can go in and seek out GDPR compliance, which is the global data privacy compliance. So they can leverage SOTI's tools to ensure they're PCI compliant. In healthcare, it's about being HIPAA compliant. So these compliances are some things that they can go and seek and showcase to their consumers that, yes, we adhere to the ISO 27001 standards, whatever standards that are kind of applicable that many consumers may be worried about. We can help companies adhere to those standards through our technology.
Some great insights, again, from someone that's helping retailers along with this technology. Well, once again, Shash, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Okay, thanks for having me, Trent. Appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Shash once again for joining us here on the podcast. Now, as far as the Looking Ahead segment is concerned, this story was first brought to our attention by the good folks at Dead and Dying Retail. By the way, if you haven't checked out their Facebook page, highly recommend you do so. We've had them on the show actually in the past, but lots of great pictures, lots of great content on there, and lots of great information. A couple of people that follow retail probably closer than anyone else I know. They shot us an email regarding Pet Value closing all of their stores. That was the first time we saw it. And the big question was, why? We just talked about Regency Centers discussing how smaller non-anchor pet stores are not only doing well, again, 98% of rents were collected from that category, but are in their leasing pipeline as these pet stores are seeking additional space and seeking to expand in general. So here we're seeing Pet Value instead close 358 U.S. stores in all, and the typical Pet Value is between 3 and 5,000 square feet. Those vacancies have to have the likes of Pet Supplies Plus and PetSense, which is owned by Tractor Supply Company, licking their chops. Now, Chief Restructuring Officer Jamie Gould said that, and I quote, the company's stores have been significantly impacted by the protracted COVID-19 related restrictions. Now, this is also a head scratcher, and I saw a number of analysts in the retail field say this doesn't really match with what we're seeing because pet stores were generally allowed to remain open, and it's something where we're continuing to see a significant number of traffic towards pet stores. PetSense obviously was part of Tractor Supply's recent earnings call. In their most recent earnings call, Tractor Supply Company saw same-store sales up 20-plus percent. They're continuing to open PetSense stores. They just opened 3 in the last quarter during the pandemic. So it can't just be about COVID here. Most of their stores were clustered in the Northeast and the Midwest, some of those markets a little bit slower to open. But when you look at analysts' consensus regarding the closures here, well, there isn't really a consensus. Some say it's because it's owned by a private equity firm and they're trying to strip out the assets. Now, the private equity firm has owned them for 11 years now. Some say it was because of difficulty shifting to e-commerce. Maybe Pet Value was a little bit behind some of their other smaller footprint brethren. Some say it was because of increased emphasis on private label products to bolster margins. Now, this is interesting because private label pet products are doing well at some retailers. In fact, Albertsons, we talked about them on a recent show, but Albertsons said their private label pet products are actually doing pretty well on a recent earnings call. But according to Jefferies research, their market share of the pet food market, just pet food, has dropped to 9.5% of the overall market share from 12.6% in the last decade. And we also talked about this notion of the fact that people will splurge more on their pets than they will on their kids, especially when it comes to food and treats. So maybe that was a reason. It's also worth noting that as recently as 2016, they were in kind of hyper-expansion mode in the upper Midwest. So maybe it was a situation where they expanded too quickly and before the money could really catch up. Now, the reality, as is always the case, or almost always the case in retail, is probably some confluence of these things. It's kind of a perfect storm, and we should keep in mind that just because a sector is doing well, I suppose it doesn't mean that every retailer in this sector would be doing well. Some retailers just aren't very well run, and it's tough because when we talk about retailers on this show, a lot of times the information we're getting from investor conferences or public earnings calls or other scenarios, the NRF conference, for example, and no one's going to say at any of those events, well, our organization is really poorly run. That's something for analysts to figure out. Even Sears Holdings, in the days prior to their bankruptcy when they were having these public earnings calls, they would not say, hey, we're a complete tire fire and we're likely to declare bankruptcy at some point. You're going to focus on the optimism there. And so it's really difficult to tell exactly why or pinpoint a reason exactly why. And it'll be interesting to see as we get further from this situation and as bankruptcy proceedings kind of play their way out, some of the details surrounding this. It'll be interesting to see also if any past execs shine some light on why this is happening. But the reason I'm looking ahead to this story, again, it is a circumstance where retailers that we know that are having a lot of success. So of this size, certainly PetSense being one of them, Pet Supplies Plus, even though they're private and again, a lot of their stores are franchised out, they seem to be having a lot of success. So who backfills these spaces? Will the shopping centers aim to backfill these spaces with similar outfits? Maybe veterinary clinics, maybe someone like a PetSense, for example. What will they backfill the spaces with? And also, is this an isolated blip, or is it a circumstance where, because so many of these pet store chains are private, maybe they're just struggling a little bit more? We get a look at macro data, see pet spending is way up, pet adoption rates are way up, but maybe that's a little bit of a mirage. I think it's more likely that we find out that Pet Value just didn't succeed for whatever reason, and I think we're going to see the smaller retailers out there smaller in terms of footprint, that is, move into these spaces, backfill these spaces. Because again, we're not just talking about, hey, this is handy for a retail landlord to have one of these because they pay rent in their shopping center, but it's also a traffic driver. Something that the folks at Pet Supplies Plus talk about is the fact that their stores will actually drive traffic to a shopping center, even if that shopping center is grocery anchored. So again, it's a benefit to have a pet-related retailer in your shopping center. And so that's what I'm looking ahead to, is what's going to backfill these spots. And also, too, you get the sense that there's some market share out there. Even though they weren't successful, Pet Value was still operating 358 stores and all. So where does all that market share go? And do the likes of Chewy, for example, cite their closure as a reason for increased market share for them on a future earnings call? As so often happens, as everyone talked about Toys R Us closures helping out their toy market share after that happened. Well, once again, thank the folks at Dead and Dying Retail for bringing that up. And by the way, I should mention too, the name of the site is not indicative, or the name of the Facebook page is not indicative of their outlooks on retail. It's simply just that they tend to cover a lot of former or past retailers on that site. But again, retail optimists at their heart. So don't let that dissuade you. We thank Shash Anand also for joining us on this show. Coming up next week, we're going to continue talking about supply chain, but it's going to be a shipping specific focus. We're going to talk to Rick Watson, the CEO and founder of RMW Commerce Consulting. He's going to talk about what retailers can ultimately do to work around some of this throttled shipping that you're seeing from the likes of UPS and FedEx, especially if they don't own their last mile services. It'll be a great conversation, and we'll see you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.